Welcome to Quinn's Empowerment Hour on the BBS Radio Network, hosted by Quinn Lay Erickson, psychotherapist, life coach, and inspirational speaker. Quinn's experience as a blind woman, a boat person from Vietnam, and a refugee has driven her to realize her dream to help you to become the best that you can be. So join Quinn every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time, for an hour of insight and inspiration for your heart, your spirit, and your soul.
I have a dream, a song to sing, to help me cope with anything.
Good evening. This is Quinn's Empowerment Hour with Quinn Lay Erickson. Thank you for joining me tonight. This show, we're going to talk about a topic that I think is very difficult and painful for many men. We are going to talk about men surviving from sexual abuse. And is sexual assault or sexual abuse is a topic that is has a lot of shame, and there's a lot of silence associated with it, and whether in men or women, but especially for men, you know, the feeling of being victimized is really difficult for men to identify with. And so tonight, I have two very special guests on the show tonight. One is a survivor of sexual abuse, severe sexual abuse himself, and another is someone who has been in the field of supporting men surviving from sexual abuse for the last 30 years. And before I introduce to you the our guest tonight, I want to introduce the topic with a clip that talks a little bit about men surviving from sexual abuse. So here is the clip.
I just experienced many symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And I thought it was just uniquely me.
Boys are sexually abused in vast numbers and vastly more frequently than as a society we're recognizing.
I was absolutely amazed that in fact it was so common among sexual abuse survivors of feeling alone or feeling it was only you.
I know that childhood rape separated me from my spirit. I thought I was broken most of my life. I struggled, fought, cried, prayed, and meditated my way back to me. While he was raping me, I felt like I left my body because I thought I was going to die. So I wasn't present there. And actually, I had agreed to die at that point. My grandmother just died last year, but she took me from my mom for about 3 months. And I don't think I would have lived without if my grandmother hadn't done that. Like, she nurtured me and sheltered me and brought me back to myself.
So our special guests on the show tonight is Don Wright and Berto Herrera. They are two men from different countries, different cultures, yet they share the same passion. They strive to help men to liberate from the emotional turmoil of sexual trauma and to break the silence and the shame surrounding sexual abuse. So let me tell you a little bit about our guests. So Don Wright. Don is the founder and executive director of the British Columbia Society for Male Survivors of Sexual Abuse, founded in 1989. This is the first agency in Canada mandated to provide recovery options for men who were victims of childhood sexual abuse, sexual assault, a recent sexual assault, or domestic violence. Over the years, Don has provided consultation and mentoring to similar organizations in many countries, including Canada, the US, Japan, New Zealand, Australia, and Great Britain, to name a few. Don was awarded the British Columbia Human Rights Medal of Honor for his pioneering work in the field, and his website is bc-malesurvivorsofsexualabuse. And our second guest is Berto Herrera, and Berto is an author, a human rights activist, a speaker, and a humanitarian. He is also a survivor of severe sexual abuse as a young boy. He was raised in a poverty-stricken family in a small village in El Salvador. Eventually, Berto left his village as a refugee and escaped to Guatemala and then Mexico. Berto is now living in Texas in the U.S. And Berto's mission, in his own words, "I want to help the needy ones and victims of abuse to let them know that they're not alone anymore. I am here for them as they strive toward the pinnacles of personal recovery." So here are the guests, and welcome to both of you.
It's good to be here.
Thank you. Good to be here too.
And Don Wright is calling from Vancouver tonight, and Berto is calling from Houston, Texas. So very happy to have you both on here tonight on a Saturday. Also, because we are live, so if you like to call in, feel free to do so. The number is 1-888-627-6008. So 1-888-627-6008. So Don, I'll start with you. Can you tell us sort of how did the British Columbia Society for Male Survivors of Sexual Abuse, what inspired you to start that society?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. I had not been that far out of university. I'd been working with a female survivor, and I was consulting with a friend of mine who worked at the Women's Sexual Assault Center about my work with this female survivor. And my colleague seemed to think I always was on the right page, so she and the executive director of the Women's Sexual Assault Center in Victoria asked me if I was interested in starting up a men's program under their umbrella. Now, when I did my university degree, my whole intention was to work with gifted children, but I thought that this was an important thing to do, and my intention was to set it up, get it running, and then, you know, leave it and go back to working with gifted children. But I stayed because I felt really committed, and very early on we realized that men needed their own program, a separate standalone agency, in order to feel recognized and validated, and for them to feel like it was a place that really belonged to them. Now, that was in 1989 in Victoria, mm-hmm. and I started the Victoria Male Survivors of Sexual Assault Society, and then 6 months later I started the Vancouver Society for Male Survivors of Sexual Abuse, and ran them as separate agencies until 1997, and then amalgamated the two and changed the name to the BC Society to reflect more of a provincial profile, and we've kept growing gradually since then. So that's kind of a fast-forward to the story of how this all happened.
And Berto, how did the sexual abuse, when did that start for you?
I was about 6 years, 7 years, when everything started. A man from the village, a well-known man and respected man in the village, he was married. He started to come to my house. For some reason, I didn't like it. I didn't feel comfortable having him around us. And suddenly, he started to touch me very inappropriately. I didn't like it. I tried to stop it, and I always let him know that I didn't want it. But he continued to do so. until from the molestation became to the sexual abuse. And the sexual abuse, it lasted like 5 years. It was an inferno for me to, it was a hell for me to live my life that way, because due to that man doing that, other men from the village started to know, and they, instead of protecting me to stop the abuse, they assumed that I like it, and I was just a little boy, an innocent, mm-hmm. ignorant boy, and they started to do the same thing.
And so, Don, in the beginning of having establishing that society and reaching out to men surviving from sexual abuse, was there a lot of challenges in being able to reach out to men?
Well, yes. I think the first challenge was just the disbelief that I was met with. People in the helping professions just sort of had a puzzled look on their face and say, well, what are you talking about? There can't be very many out there. Mm-hmm. And I knew that wasn't true, because children are vulnerable, and the rate of boy-girl victimization is quite similar in larger communities. It's going to be about a 50-50 distribution. And I just knew that men were, it was really difficult for them to talk about this kind of vulnerability and the shame and guilt attached to it. So I just, forged on ahead and kept kind of pushing against the tide. And, it's taken me 26 years, but I think people are beginning to catch on and accepting the fact that men can be abused and women can be offenders. And the other problem, of course, was funding, and still is. We run a deficit every month, but we're committed to our clients, and we will not discontinue services to a client regardless if their compensation runs out or if they just don't have money, because it's too important. Men reach out to us in good faith, and it's important for us to meet their need. And it's not up to them to float the agency. That's our job. And I have some support from the government, but it is inadequate. So we struggle, but we get by because we're committed.
And Berto, as a child and experiencing the abuse, what were some of your struggles?
Growing up, at that time, it was very difficult for me to cope with everything and to understand mm-hmm. what was happening to me. And I was a Catholic, and I'm still a Catholic, and a believer in Jesus, in the Lord. And it was difficult for me to understand why, Lord, why Jesus is letting these evil men doing it to me. Why he doesn't stop that? Of course, at that time I couldn't really understand the situation. And growing up, it was difficult. It was not easy at all. It was a challenge in my life, to the point that I went through psychology and, a lot of therapy what I went through. So I was 5 years with a psychologist and 2 years with a psychiatrist and 7 years taking antidepressive medications. The whole combination therapy is what did help me to come out with everything and who I am right now, thanks to Jesus and thanks to those people who did help me professionally.
And so, Don, following up with that, what have you noticed about men talking about childhood sexual abuse? What was it like for them?
Well, it's interesting. Of course, there's a wide range of, mm-hmm. of ways in which men have coped with it and framed it as a way of understanding it or as a way of getting through. A lot of men bury their memories. A lot of men bury their feelings. There's kind of a misconception that men don't want to have their feelings. I think that they do. I think they need the safety and the permission to have their feelings without judgment. And there's a great deal of emotional openness in my groups, and it's amazing to see what men are capable of. if they're given an opportunity, if they're given the safety and the acceptance to be real and to look deep within themselves and access those feelings, work through those memories, and the support and the respect they give one another, is it's amazing to see that happening. It certainly is a challenge, and one of the things that I think is certainly problematic is very often during the abuse there can be an arousal response, and that's very confusing for the victim because they think, I must have liked this. Maybe I'm gay if it's a male offender.
Yes.
That's not true. It's biological functionality. The analogy I use, if I touch you with a lit cigarette, it's going to burn whether you want it to or not. So when a perpetrator is stimulating your body, all the nerve endings pick up the signal and your body does what it's designed to do. It has nothing to do with wanting that experience, and it has nothing to do with wanting to be with that person. It's just biological functionality. But a child doesn't understand that, and that shame is something that's carried around for decades until they finally have an opportunity to work through that and finally let go of it. The shame belongs to the offender, not the victim.
No, that's a very important point, Don, because that's something I often hear, you know, with women too, the sexual abuse, right? Because like you said, there's a physiological response, but yet because of that, so there's a lot of shame associated with it. Like you said, like they thought, or it's even some abusers thought that the victims enjoyed it.
Well, I think offenders often know that the victim doesn't enjoy it, but they will use that to make the victim carry some of the responsibility. They want the victim to feel that they're equally responsible, and that helps the victim stay silent. And so they use all kinds of manipulations to maintain the control over the victim and to make them feel ashamed and I've had clients that their offender said, oh, if you ever tell anyone about this, they're going to know that you're gay. Well, whether the child is or isn't, that's beside the point, but that keeps the child silent because they're so afraid of people's judgment. And that's just the manipulation of the offender.
And Berto, what were some of your fears at the time when that happened?
What Don is saying, it's true, because in the village where I live, and there was another village around, there was a man who was a gay, and at that time, for everybody, it was like out of question, so they didn't accept that, and my abuser, he always kept telling me, blaming me for everything, and he always threatened me and say that if I say anything, he was going to tell everybody, and especially my little friends that I used to play football with, that I was gay. So to me, that was like a ceiling to me. Like I couldn't say anything. I was so afraid and terrorized just to imagine that people will know that I was gay. That was one of the things. And then the other threat that he kept doing to me was that he was going to do the same thing to my sister. And just to think that my sister was going to go through the pain, what I was going through at that time, it was enough for me to bear the pain, to bear the abuse, and just to put up with.
And he also threatened to kill you as well at some point, didn't he?
Yes, that is correct. There was a moment, a point when he bought a knife, and he told me that he bought a knife just for my throat because he wanted to feel what it feels to kill somebody. And at that time, I mean, he put it the knife on my throat, and he was ready to kill me. But for the grace of God and the Holy Spirit, I'm here. So I was saved.
That's a horrible story. No child should have to go through that.
Yeah. How long did that last, Berto?
The whole abuse, the inferno, what I went through, it lasted for over 5 years. It was like a 5.5 years altogether. And I was really, really sexually abused, really bad, by 9 men and 2 women. So that was 11 adults altogether. And there were days, evenings, when I was abused by 3 men in the same evening. It was terrible. It was like, there were days, that's why my favorite songs are I Have a Dream, I Believe in Angels, and One Day at a Time, because to me, I just kept praying to the Lord, praying to Jesus, just one day at a time, because that evening when I was not abused, to me, it was like, wow, thank you, Lord. Thanks, Jesus, for not letting those people come close to me. So that's why my favorite song is still I Believe in Angels and One Day at a Time.
And you talked about, I listened to your one of your shows, and you talked about how you shared with your mother and she didn't believe you.
That was the worst thing that can happen to a child, to anybody, but especially when you are a little boy, a little girl. At that time, I was just a little boy, and I told my mother. When I was going through the abuse, through the molestation, not through the sexual abuse. Only if my mother could have paid attention to me and believed me and believed that little boy who was really screaming, crying for help, praying for help. But my mother chose not to believe me. And instead, she slapped my face, saying that I was being disrespectful with Mr. So-and-so. So due to her not believing me, then the molestation kept going on, and until that turned into sexual abuse. That was very hard for me. That was very difficult for me, because at that point, I was like, I am alone. I have nobody. I am on my own. And I remember that night, I cried and cried. And there was a moment when I said, like, okay, so if my mother didn't believe me, so who are you going to talk to? So it was, to me, it was kind of like closing my mouth and never wanted to tell nobody.
Yeah, and that must be very, almost like a sense of betrayal.
Yes, yes, I felt that way.
And so, Don, is that a common struggle for men, kind of sharing and people don't believe them?
Yeah, I think it's all too common. Some men have been lucky enough to have somebody, whether it be a parent or a sibling or a best friend, that believe them. But so many men, they either they're not believed in the first place, or someone doesn't really validate their experience as abusive. For example, if a young boy is abused by a woman, very often, if he tells another male, very often the response is, oh, you're so lucky, she's pretty attractive, mm-hmm. you know, I wish I'd had a go at her. Well, it's not a pleasant experience for this boy, that's why he's upset by it. But he's left thinking, oh, well, there's something wrong with me, that's a woman, I'm supposed to like it. Well, you know, he may be 11 or 12 years old and the woman is 35, and it's not right. And yet he's being told that it's supposed to be an experience that he welcomes, and of course it's not.
And so, Berto, as a child, what helped you cope? You talked a lot about praying. Anything else that really helped you?
Praying was my first thing, my strongest thing, and still it is. I am a strong believer in Jesus. I always pray and sing my favorite songs, like I have a friend who loves me, who loves me, and his name is Jesus Christ. And I always believed in Saint Michael, the archangel. I had visions, I had dreams, and I always believed that Jesus was with me, no matter what. And I'm really a strong, willing person. I mean, I have a strong mind, and it's like I was determined that one day this is going to stop. I don't know when, but this is going to stop. This is not going to last forever. And praying and praying and praying, it was something like I just couldn't tell you how much I prayed to the Lord and to Jesus. And of course, there were times when I questioned it. I got upset with God. I got upset with Jesus. There were times when I didn't even wanted to go to mass, wanted to go to church, because why should I go to church when you, God, don't listen to me, when you, Jesus, left me out? So you are not there when I need you most. So it was very difficult, but at the same time, I went back to praying, and that is what kept me strong.
And Don, with other, when men talked about their childhood, what might be some of the things for people to know about that can help children who were sexually abused?
Well, I think the most important thing is that the child be heard and that they be believed, and that whoever is hearing this do whatever they can to stop the abuse from continuing. That is exactly, you know, your other guest's story, is that he told his mother, who did not believe him, and actually punished him for what he had disclosed. And that's the very opposite. Children should be believed and supported and kept safe. And in a way, that's the responsible of every adult, is to look out for the well-being of the children around us. It doesn't even have to be your own child. If you know that a child is hurting, you have to do something to protect that child and to advocate for them.
And Berto, how did the abuse stop?
The abuse is stopped because, believing in Jesus, there was a moment when an eagle, I call it a bird because I was so innocent, ignorant, I never saw, I didn't know what the difference was of an eagle, a bird, and I used to call it a bird, a big bird. It came to help me and talk to me and help me, save me from many times that I was ready to kill myself, to suicide, commit suicide. But the Holy Spirit came in a form of an eagle and attacked the abuser. So that helps a lot to stop the abuse right from him. And then what it did help to stop everything from everybody, it was that I told him to stop because the eagle was going to hurt him. And the eagle did hurt him. It did really got him. And then he told some other men to stop doing what he was doing to me. And then we left the village as a refugees. We went to San Salvador, the capital. So when we went over there, those men were behind. They left to another villages, or they left to the mountain as a guerrillas, so rebels. So all that, it did help to stop everything.
And so, Don, for men who struggle with a history of sexual abuse, what might be some of the issues that you see that they would struggle with as adults?
Well, we've mentioned shame, and that certainly is a big one because that keeps them silent. But very closely connected to that is the lack of trust, particularly when the betrayal was someone close at hand. Umberto's mother, for example, betrayed him by not protecting him. So if you can't trust your family members or people that are close to you, how can you trust you know, strangers or the wide world. And so survivors very often have a great deal of difficulty trusting, and they very often keep themselves isolated because they don't trust. There's certainly low self-esteem. The message is that you're not worth anything. All you're good for is to be used for the pleasure of the offender. I mean, that's, of course, a false message, but that's what the message the child gets. And so they grow up thinking that they are not important, that their needs don't count, and, you know, their boundaries are not to be respected. One of the things that I think is rather disturbing is that a lot of, survivors, both male and female, end up in the sex trade. And that's because the message is that their sexuality is a commodity. It's something that can be traded for money, drugs, alcohol, a place to stay. They don't see sexuality as a way of being intimate with someone that they really care about and, showing their love and affection for another person. They see it as simply something to be traded because that's what the abuse taught them. There's a whole list of impact, but those are some of the bigger ones. Certainly, sexual abuse is a boundary violation, so very often survivors don't have good boundaries. They don't know how to say no, or they don't know how to protect their own personal space, or they put such a huge wall around themselves that nobody gets close. So certainly boundaries are a big issue, and very closely attached to boundaries is the idea of identity, because if you don't have boundaries, you can't really define who you are. So survivors who don't have really clear boundaries also have a very unclear sense of who they are. Until they start establishing their boundaries, they have sort of a nebulous sense of self that kind of just goes with the wind or responds to the pressures around them. But, you know, everyone is unique. There are common issues that come up, but everyone has their own variation on each one of those issues.
And in terms of women and versus men, what might be some differences, Don?
Well, I think there's really two differences that I think are fairly closely related. Mm-hmm. I've worked with probably about 50 female survivors over the last quarter century. And I've never heard a female survivor say that she was confused about her sexual orientation because of the abuse. Now, I'm not to say it never happens, but the majority of men who've been sexually abused at some point are confused, partly because of the response that I mentioned earlier, partly because we're taught as men that we're supposed to be tough, in control, in charge, and that if we are victimized, if we are submissive, then we are kind of in a traditional feminine role. So men feel like their sexuality has been diminished, their sexual identity has been diminished, as well as their sexual orientation, which are very closely related. Women who are victimized and emotionally vulnerable don't feel like that's a violation of society's view of how women are supposed to be. I mean, women certainly are not supposed to be abused. But it's okay for a woman to be emotional, to feel vulnerable, to need protection. So when a woman is victimized, she doesn't feel like her femininity has been reduced. Not to say that it's not a traumatic experience in itself, but I think that's really one of the main differences, is that men do feel like their masculinity has been diminished by being victimized, and there's that confusion about their sexual orientation. So I think that's the main difference. Pretty much everything else is similar, you know, the self-blame, the shame, the guilt, low self-esteem, the distrust issues, the depression, all the rest are pretty similar. I think those are the two main differences, is the orientation and the how you define yourself within your gender.
And how about you, for you, Berardo? What have been some of the struggles for you growing as adult?
Some of the struggles that I went through for a while, it was like what Don is saying. So I do really agree with him 100%. So because for women who are sexually abused, yes, it is a problem, because that no child, no girl, no boy should go through that traumatic situation. But for women, it's like they don't feel like they're, it's kind of diminished, you know, they're, because they are women. But for men, it's very difficult to go through that. Although I was always very clear who I was, and I was a man, and I was abused, and I didn't like it, and I was never okay with it. But still, I felt like who I am. There were moments in my life when I was questioning myself. And until I went through the psychology therapy and medications and the everything, the whole thing, it did help me and talk to some other sexual abuse survivors who shared with me what they went through. And I saw a lot of struggling with them, like drugs, alcohol, confusion. And even I met two people who were like bisexuals, going out with women, with men. And I was like, I'm not going to go through that. So, and all that, it did help me to be who I am and somebody different, and to recognize that it's not my fault, has never been my fault, I am not guilty, and if there is somebody who is guilty, then his name is, and I say it, you know, aloud, who the person was, the guilty person. So all that, it did help me to really overcome everything.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just, in your book, Berto, you've written a book called The Invincible Flying Eagle. You talked a lot about the abuse itself and a lot about forgiveness. Can you share with us sort of, that journey of forgiveness for you and what that has meant for you?
Yes. It's very difficult, but it's easy at the same time, because there were moments when I was getting sick of my heart and in my mind. I was getting those feelings, bad feelings, like revenge, like I want to kill them. I was a little boy, but I was already thinking, I want to kill him. I want to kill him. So, and I got sick and sick of that, losing my sleep. And there was moments when I was like, if I got so upset because I was abused, it lasted like a week, 2 weeks, like a month. And then I was like, no, I'm not going to let these people define who I am, who I'm going to be. It's not worth it. I want to be happy. How am I going to do it? I ask for directions, and I pray to Jesus. Then I saw the adults behaving badly, doing so many bad things to me, and then they acted like if nothing happened. I don't want to be like them. I started to forgive. And when I forgave those people, suddenly I started to feel like, wow, I can get mad. I can get upset. People can do it to me once, but they are not going to do it to me twice. And I started to feel like a relief, like I can breathe. I can go to bed. I can forgive people today, and tomorrow is another beautiful day. So, and then I started to call it the superpower of forgiveness, because forgiving, it's freeing yourself, living a new life. And that is what I am doing, and that is what I did.
So you started thinking about forgiving even as a boy, or was it more... As an adult?
As a boy. When I started to forgive, really from my heart and with my mind, that was when I was like 9 years old. I was still going through the abuse at that time.
Yeah.
When I started to forgive those people. Yes.
And you talked about meeting up with the abusers recently. What was that like?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
What was that like?
It was emotional, mixed feelings. That was on the 2010 when I went back to El Salvador after so many years. I had the chance to encounter two of the abusers. I talked to them. One didn't accept it. He was like, "I don't know what you're talking about. Really, you don't know what I'm talking about." And I explained to him. I told him everything exactly, the moments, the places, what he did to me, and so forth. And then he started to look someplace else, looking down. And I told him, "Look at my face. Look who I am now. I am a man. I am a grown man. And thanks God, I am a person who believes in God and who really is an example to the community. And if you are doing, if you are still doing what you were doing to me, please, you have to stop doing that." But he didn't accept it. Then at the end, he went okay a little bit. And I gave him a hug. And I told him that I forgive him, and I forgave him long time ago. And then the other man, yes, he accepted right away. He apologized. And the same thing, I gave him a hug, and I say, "You know, I forgive you. If I give you a hug, it doesn't mean I am okay with it. It doesn't mean what you did, it was right. No, it's wrong. But I am giving you this hug for you to know that I am a person of God. I am a Christian. And you have to stop. If you are doing it, you have to stop what you are doing. Don't hurt other child."
So, Don, forgiveness is a very personal thing. And I think that's something that a lot of people really struggle with. Can you comment on that?
It is a very complex issue. And I think that everyone has to make their own decision about that. But I think what causes some difficulty for some survivors is that they think that forgiveness means that the offender is off the hook, that they don't have to be accountable, that they can just go merrily on their way. And really, it's not about that. It's about letting go with the obsession with the offender. As Umberto says, it's very toxic to hold that hatred and that resentment inside of you. It's like you've got food poisoning. It's almost like that. It hurts you. So forgiveness is about letting go of hanging on to that anger and that resentment, and just allowing yourself to just walk away from that and to start really putting your life together. And I do think that in some instances, the kind of confrontation that Umberto described can be very healing if the offender is prepared to listen and to hear what you have to say, whether they agree or not, at least if you are given them the opportunity to have your voice. But unfortunately, in some cases, to confront the offender could actually be quite dangerous, and so it's not something that one does lightly. But yeah. Forgiveness, to me, is really about letting go of waiting for the offender to take responsibility, because some of them never will. Now, if an offender comes around and says, "I realize what I did to you, I'm so sorry, I wish I could go back in time and undo it, is there anything I can do to make it up to you?" then I would say that person has earned real forgiveness. But letting them off the hook and saying, "Oh, well, you don't have to worry about it, you don't have to be afraid, I'm not going to come after you, I'm not going to charge you," that's not what it's about. But again, it's a very personal process that everyone must decide for themselves if they are going to forgive and what that really means. But I think the real important part of that is letting go of it and not holding it inside, because as long as you've got that obsessive hold on it, you're never really free of the abuse, because every day you're waiting for somehow the scales to be balanced and the offender to be accountable. And you can't wait for that, because in some cases they never are. Mm-hmm. But you have to get on with your life.
And it's a balance too, I would imagine, right? Being able to acknowledge what happened at first, sometimes forgiving too fast, and not being able to acknowledge this has been a huge impact on my life.
I think that just kind of what you're saying, that if the forgiveness comes too early, I think in effect what it is that the survivor is saying, I'll carry the burden, you, the offender, don't have to.
Yeah.
And that's not the way it's supposed to be. Like the offender must carry that responsibility for the rest of their lives, because they are the one that did this. The survivor, with the help of therapy and prayer or whatever it takes, will eventually let go of the burden of the abuse and be able to get their life back and be able to live a full, satisfying life. But the offender must go to their grave knowing what they've done and to never forget.
Beside forgiveness, Don, what are some of the things that men can do to help them heal?
Well, I think it is important to get professional help, because one of the analogies I use is that when you have your nose up against the painting, all you see is the brush strokes. And that's what it's like for a survivor. They're so enmeshed in the aftermath of the abuse. I mean, the abuse itself is painful psychologically, physically, emotionally. But the worst part of it is the way in which you carry that abuse for sometimes decades. The shame, the guilt, the lack of trust, all the things that we've talked about, the survivors have to carry that sometimes for decades. And that's what's so horrible about the abuse. If it was an isolated incident and there was no carryover, you'd be able to shrug it off. But it's not like that. It affects you in profound ways. So getting professional help, the therapist can help you see the patterns that you're too close, that you don't see them as clearly. And there's a lot of different techniques that therapists use to help alleviate the guilt, the shame, to validate the deeper feelings, to be able to find a way to express your anger that doesn't hurt yourself or other people, but really gets to the core issues. Some psychiatrists believe too much in medication. I think medication has its place, but some psychiatrists don't really want to look at the trauma. They don't want to talk about it. They just want to give you a prescription and send you home. But that is not enough. You have to really take a look at the impact that the abuse has had on you. Now, sometimes if you're deeply depressed, doing therapy is too overwhelming. So moderate medication will take the edge off the depression, so you can take a look at what it's all about and work through it. Or if your anxiety is extremely high, you can't do therapy because it's too overwhelming. So again, mild medication to bring down the anxiety means that you can handle the anxiety, figure out what it's all about, and with the help of a therapist, work through it. So now the combination of the kind of insight or talk therapy and moderate medication for a period of time is probably more likely to gain a positive outcome.
And Berto, you have done a lot since you come to the U.S. Can you share with us some of the things you have done, you know, as a result of learning to heal from the sexual abuse?
I committed myself to really help people, help everybody. I have a lot of people who send me messages on Twitter, and especially men sharing with me what they went through and ask me for advice and telling and asking me really to pray for them and to help them out. I go to Central America. I do conferences. I talk about sexual abuse, about molestation, about domestic violence, how to prevent it, that we have to talk about, we have to do something, and I always share with them. What I went through, it was so unimaginable. It was painful. But what was wrong with those men when one was the abuser, number one, and then the number two, when he knew that instead of protecting me, instead of doing something to stop that, he became the number two, then the number three. So I try to really make that clear to people. If you know something, if you hear something, you must act, stop. You be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And I collect food, medications, money, and I take it to the needy ones. I try to do the best I can. And when I help somebody, I help those people with my money, out of my own money. I don't say I'm going to help them with $50 because it's leftover. I don't use leftovers. I use it included in my budget. What I do for my living, for my family, I do for other people if I can.
And Don, can you share us some of the things you have done with the, you've gone to different countries and...
Right. Well, certainly a big part of my job is providing direct therapy, both individual and group therapy, to my own caseload. But we have a training program. I have master's level students that come to my agency for an 8-month training period. And we've had clients come to us from, or no, sorry, we've had students come to us from universities in 8 countries. And now we're starting to train doctoral students to do this kind of work. So I've probably trained probably somewhere between 40 and 50 therapists to do this kind of work through my agency. And of the 12 therapists I have working for me, all except for one of them started out as practicum students. So I've got 8 months to really get to know the quality of person they are and their skill set, and the really good students I've kept as the agency continues to grow gradually. And I've also spoken at conferences across the United States and Canada. And I had some students coming over from Japan every summer for about 5 years. They would spend time with me. They'd spend time with a women's program and then at the Justice Institute, which is a training school for justice-related issues. And several of these people, when they went back to Japan, wrote a series of guidebooks. One is to how to work with children who are survivors, how to work with women, and another book on how to work with men. And they credited their time with me for the information that they put in the book for working with male survivors. Also, one of my staff started out as a student, and after his practicum, he stayed with us and worked with us for about 5 years. And then he's from Japan, so he moved back to Japan, and he started an agency in Japan for male survivors, and it's the first in his country. So he's doing in Japan now what I did in Canada 25 years or 26 years ago.
Yeah, that must be quite powerful.
As well as, you know, I have given advice and guidance to people in the places that you've mentioned, New Zealand, Australia, Great Britain, because these are newer agencies that wanted to get some inspiration or some guidance as to how to go about setting up these kinds of programs.
No, really amazing work, both of you. Perto, what has been the proudest thing in your life?
Say again, I'm sorry.
What are you most proud about in your life that you've done?
Wow, the most proud of my life for who I am. I don't do drugs. I am not a person who is going to abuse somebody else. To me, that is just out of my mind since I was a little boy, since I didn't like it. How am I going to do it to somebody else? Instead, I'm here to help other people. I have a good intentions for everybody. I pray for everybody. I want to be a good person, a good an example of man for others. And I am proud of myself how I manage it, everything. And you know what? I love my mother. Even though that my mother did wrong, didn't believe me, I love my mother because it's my mother. So thanks to her, I am here. It doesn't mean that I excuse her for not believing me, but yes, it is so many things that I am proud of who I am.
And when did she learn about your the abuse that you experienced, your mother?
That was on, I believe it was on the 2001, when I had the chance to sit down and talk to her. And still, until this moment, she doesn't believe me, and she's still saying that I made those things up, and I am a liar. So for my mother, I am a liar.
Even today?
Even today, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Even today,
and,
I spoke with her
you
yesterday.
Somehow you are at peace with it.
I'm sorry?
Somehow you are at peace with it too.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I spoke with her yesterday. She lives in Los Angeles, California. And when she starts to talk to me about that, I just go, yes, mother, it's okay, mother. Because I don't want to fight. I don't want to argue with nobody, especially with my mother. You know, I'm in peace. I know who I am, and she doesn't believe me, and it's okay.
And so, Don, what are you most proud of in your work?
Oh, well, just the fact that I've created this agency. You know, I've had this sensation. I'm leaving the office at the end of my day, and I look back, and the lights are on. I know that there's therapists up there conducting a group, and I think I did that. I created a place that men can come and feel safe and get the kind of healing that they need. And I get a lot of appreciation that men voice towards the agency, and it's such a sacred, special place for them because they know that they're believed and they're supported and they're cared about. And so at the end of the day, I know that I've done something worthwhile. I mean, I could have taken my degree and gone, you know, a number of different directions with it. So I created something unique in this country, and it's been the inspiration for other agencies starting up. And so, yes, I feel proud about that.
Yeah, so you've left a legacy. Well,
yeah.
You're still doing the legacy right now.
Yeah, I'm 68, and I should have retired 3 years ago, but I'm committed.
Oh, yeah.
So I've got a couple more years to go, I think, before they kick me out.
So Don, for the men who are listening to the show and who might still be struggling with the sexual trauma that they experienced, what would you like to say to them?
Well, if you're fortunate enough to live in a city where there is a service, and unfortunately there aren't very many, by all means reach out. If you don't have any kind of service in your community that specializes in male survivors, find a therapist that you feel like you can talk to and that will at least listen. If they listen and accept you and are kind and supportive, they may not understand the deep complexity of sexual abuse, but at least that support and that acceptance is a step in the right direction. There's also some really good books out. There's one called Victims No Longer by Mike Liu. It's probably one of the best books because it's easily accessible for survivors. You don't have to have a degree in psychology to get through it. But it's also helpful for therapists that are new to the field to learn about the issues. So it's quite a good book. I recommend it. It's on the top of my reading list. And there is more literature out now. So I would say go to the library and see what you can find. You can also go online and check out our website, which is bc-malesurvivors.com. But there's also malesurvivors.org, I think, is the web address. And it's an organization in the States. I used to be on the board of directors of that organization. And they have chat rooms, and they have a major conference every 2 years in New York. So those conferences are both for service providers and for male survivors themselves. And they're amazing because all the main people in the field go to these conferences and present. And some of the workshops are for professionals, some for survivors, some are open to both. But it's a lot of men who are not willing or ready to speak to somebody can go to their websites and get a lot of information and engage in some of the chat room discussions and so on. So it's a good first step for a lot of men who are not quite ready to do a face-to-face with somebody. They can go online and start engaging in the dialogue and do some learning and get some support.
And Berto, how about you? What would you like to say to the male listeners tonight?
I would like to say that they are survivors, and we are survivors, not victims, because that is a terrible feeling, and it's wrong for us to say we are a victim. I am not a victim, and the, people have to stop, have to realize that. When you feel like a victim, you are going to be a victim all the time. But if, when you stop saying, I am a victim, that I am a survivor, that is the powerful thing that we can do for ourselves. And that is what men need to do. And if they need help, like Don say, you know, they can reach out to anybody, to a psychologist, to a group therapist. It did help me, and I really do recommend that. And if they want to send me a message, I am on Twitter, Berto Herrera. And also, if they will like to read my book, it's on Amazon.com, The Invincible Flying Eagle. It's in Spanish and English. And most of the proceeds of my book, it's money that I use to give it away to people who need it. And I have helped people to go to college, to university, and also for people who have no money to go to psychologist and go through therapy. I pay for that too, because we all deserve to have a happy life, not to live and with a trauma.
I just want to say I agree completely with the idea of, you know, the difference between victim and survivor. Usually the term victim is only used in the legal context to differentiate between the offender and the person that the crime was committed against. An interviewer asked me one time about that, you know, the difference between survivor and a victim. I said, think of a shipwreck. The victims went down with the ship. The survivors made it to shore. And Umberto is absolutely right. Male survivors have an incredible amount of resilience. They survived the trauma as a child. So I know that they can survive the rigors of therapy, and they are survivors because they have gone beyond the abuse, and they've flourished, and they've grown. So survivor is certainly a better term, but there's even a place beyond that. There's a point when you're beyond a survivor that you've completely regained your life, and you're living your life fully the way you're meant to in the first place. And that's kind of beyond being a survivor even. But you're right, the term victim can be demeaning, and it can make a person feel less than, or somehow that they're damaged or stuck. And that certainly isn't the case. It's appropriate within the context of a legal discussion, but beyond that, survivor is certainly a better term to use.
So thank you very much for both of you for very powerful stories tonight and insights. I'm very honored and very appreciative for you to come onto my show tonight. To learn more about Don Wright, go to his website, bc-malesurvivors.com, and to find out about Berto Herrera's book, The Invincible Flying Eagle, which you can find on Amazon.com. Thank you very much for joining me tonight, and see you again two Saturdays from now, December 12, when we will talk about sexual assault experienced by women. So have a great night.
I'm only human. I'm just a man. Help me believe in what I could be and all that I am.
This is Quinn's Empowerment Hour, hosted by Quinlay Erickson, every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time. For more information about Quinn, visit www.quinle.com. Thank you so much for tuning in, and you have a beautiful, restful sleep. Good night.